What does it actually take to uncover the truth when someone is determined to hide it? Criminal investigations bear little resemblance to the tidy narratives we see on television. There are no predetermined dots to connect, no guaranteed outcomes, no convenient confessions that wrap everything up in 60 minutes. Instead, sophisticated criminals deploy a maze of shell companies, intermediaries, cash transactions, and forged documents designed specifically to defeat detection. The investigator's greatest challenge isn't just following the evidence, it's maintaining genuine curiosity about the truth without becoming wedded to your first theory. This lesson hit home during a devastating phone call in 1989. My best friend Jessica sobbed as she told me that Jose and Kitty, her parents' lifelong friends, had been brutally murdered in their Beverly Hills mansion, shotgun blasts at close range while they ate ice cream and watched television. Police initially suspected organized crime. Months later, Jessica called again, distraught that police had mistakenly arrested the couple's sons, Lyle and Eric Menendez. She was absolutely certain of their innocence. Eventually, the brothers confessed to killing their parents, claiming self-defense after years of abuse. What followed became one of the most sensational criminal cases of the 1990s. Jessica's father said learning the truth was worse than losing Kitty and Jose. What haunted Jessica most was her own blindness to what turned out to be true. In our all-night conversation after the confession, we reached one devastating conclusion. You can never truly know someone else's mind or heart. This shaped my entire career as a prosecutor, developing healthy skepticism about both guilt and innocence, keeping an open mind even about privileged, well-educated sons from wealthy families. How many people do you judge by appearance or admire for wealth and power? Constant cynicism exhausts, but blind trust is naive. The middle ground, healthy skepticism and due diligence, is essential for identifying malicious conduct. On my 10th day as U.S. attorney, Hassan Nemazi, a prominent Iranian-American businessman, was arrested for bank fraud. Harvard-educated, politically connected, generous philanthropist, Nemazi was no ordinary target. He calmly claimed it was a misunderstanding. His lawyer promised Nemazi would repay the $74.9 million the next day. Remarkably, he did. But he'd simply defrauded another bank that morning using identical tactics. The investigation exposed Nemazi's life of lies. He had defrauded banks of more than $290 million by inventing financial institutions, forging signatures, and fabricating documents. Despite his Maserati, private jet, and yacht, it was all a gold-plated charade. Sophisticated banks never called, visited, or verified. His appearance and connections created an aura of trustworthiness. Like Bernie Madoff, Nemazi manipulated smart people through charm and exclusivity. What deters con artists isn't just agents with badges, it's the knowledge that everyone will ask questions and require proof. Kenny McCabe exemplified investigative mastery through total immersion. He spent decades on New York streets, memorizing faces, names, and connections across the Italian mafia. Unlike rotating agents, Kenny developed irreplaceable specialized knowledge that helped topple multiple godfathers from the Bonanno and Lucchese families. His encyclopedic memory provided crucial links in major cases. When prosecutor James Comey needed to connect a Lucchese member with a Gambino capo, Kenny instantly recalled a 1983 wedding where both families attended. In 2004, he was first to reveal that Vincent Vinny Gorgeous Basciano had taken over the Bonanno family. Despite his reputation for toughness, Kenny remained scrupulously honest and respectful. He never yelled at mobsters, took surveillance photos openly, and spoke courteously to targets. He understood that true toughness comes from character, not intimidation. A bronze plaque honors Kenny as the one indispensable person in this country's battle against La Cosa Nostra. Initial judgments are inevitable, but most disasters are reversible if reconsidered early. The problem? Once formed, opinions become nearly impossible to abandon. Witnesses stick to first identifications, doctors to initial diagnoses, lawyers to their first assessments. This confirmation bias proves particularly dangerous in criminal justice, where liberty and lives hang in the balance. Brandon Mayfield's case illustrates this perfectly. After the 2004 Madrid train bombings killed 191 people, FBI analysts concluded a fingerprint from the detonators matched Mayfield, an Oregon lawyer who had converted to Islam. Three FBI experts confirmed the match, leading to his surveillance and detention. Spanish authorities persistently doubted the match. Mayfield hadn't left the U.S. in 10 years, had no valid passport, and no connection to Spain. Only when Spanish police identified the print as belonging to an Algerian suspect did the FBI rescind their finding, eventually paying Mayfield $2 million. FBI examiners fixated on perceived similarities while rationalizing away differences that should have ruled out the match. The greatest danger to justice often comes not from corrupt officers, but from competent professionals who forget to question their own conclusions. Deep understanding requires active inquiry. Searching questions probe beneath surface explanations. Uncomfortable questions challenge assumptions, and hypothetical questions test boundaries. In criminal law, asking innumerable questions prevents embarrassment, errors, and miscarriages of justice. Dumb questions expose superficial reasoning and fake experts. These basic inquiries strip away jargon to reveal core truths. The world is full of bullshit artists using acronyms they can't expand, from financial advisors throwing around derivatives to tech consultants misusing blockchain and AI. Smart people hate looking dumb, which can be their greatest weakness. As a young prosecutor handling complex fraud cases, every stupid question about accounting principles moved me away from failure. When my colleague Josh Levine was thrown into a complex securities fraud session unprepared, he brilliantly told the witness, "Pretend I'm your 9-year-old nephew." Even as U.S. attorney, I felt nervous confronting new challenges. Self-doubt in moderation drives careful consideration and thorough preparation. My favorite question, "Why do we do it this way?" often yielded the worst possible answer, "We've always done it that way." Asking questions fosters thoughtfulness rather than rote acceptance of the status quo. Criminal informants occupy a moral gray area, pairing criminals seeking leniency with prosecutors pursuing convictions. They provide insider access no surveillance can match, yet bring serious credibility concerns. Their impact is undeniable. Sammy the Bull Gravano dismantled the Gambino crime family. Joseph Massino brought down the Bananos, and corporate informants exposed Enron and WorldCom. Even Lance Armstrong, who passed 150 drug tests, was undone by 11 cooperating teammates. The full confession approach, requiring complete transparency, including unknown crimes, balanced transactional cooperation with atonement. This yielded an unexpected benefit, exonerating the innocent when cooperators confessed to crimes for which others were wrongfully imprisoned. Through debriefing sessions, prosecutors discover their adversaries' complete humanity, troubled childhoods, family struggles, personal demons, transforming adversaries into allies and creating emotional bonds that raise complex ethical questions about justice and redemption. Prosecutorial discretion is essential to justice. Without it, we'd face mechanical enforcement without wisdom. Legal authority begins the analysis but doesn't end it. Sometimes the most just decision is walking away from a technically viable case. Beyond procedure lie deeper values: mercy, forgiveness, and redemption. After white supremacist Mark Anthony Stroman shot Rhys Buyen in the face during a post-9/11 hate crime spree, leaving him with 38 pellets embedded and one eye nearly blind, Buyen forgave his attacker. He campaigned 2 years to spare Stroman from execution, saying simply, "He's another human being, like me." Stroman transformed, writing before his 2011 execution, "I'm very grateful for Rhys Buyen's efforts to save my life after I tried to end his." His final words acknowledge that hate causes a lifetime of pain. The law has limits. It cannot compel love or conquer evil. In our age of tribal anger, the courtroom offers a different model: structured deliberation, reasoned debate, and recognition that truth is complex. Justice springs as much from the heart as from the head.